Monster Man, special episode, Bestiaries. Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Today's episode is a special episode brought to you by the generosity and public spirit of my Patreon backers, and in particular, of Patreon backer Tobias, who asked me to talk about bestiaries in-game. If you'd like to be like Tobias and get your own special episode, remember that all you have to do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do, you'll also receive the rewards for pledging at the $2 and $1 levels. So Tobias, thank you very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoyed today's episode. So when we were discussing this episode, Tobias said, I was, quote, "I was thinking about bestiaries and whether it'd be fun to have an in-game bestiary for my players to interact with." I thought this was a really interesting idea. You know, for the most part, game books, there are games that have kind of in-character documents. So examples of that would be things like in Vampire, you know, for Masquerade, like the Book of Nod, or for Requiem, the Testament of Longinus, which are like in-setting texts. And there are examples of that in Glorantha as well, I think, where, you know, like the travels of Baturi and Varosh are, you know, in-universe fiction that someone could learn about the setting from. Or like, you know, King of Sartar is like compiled from documents that would exist within the setting, although within the future of the setting, so that might not be a good example. But bestiaries are kind of the exception. There are actually a number of games that have bestiaries that are written at least partly from an in-universe standpoint. So the idea of player characters interacting with a bestiary in-game is an interesting one. So I wanted to start this episode by taking a look at kind of bestiaries in the Middle Ages, which is sort of, I think, the genre that we're talking about when we think of a bestiary, but then also a little bit looking at some other examples from other literary genres, and then we'll go on to looking at how you could use documents of this type in a game. So to start with, in medieval Europe, bestiaries are an important literary genre, and they're maybe the closest thing to a real-world analog of a book like the Monster Manual. Not only in terms of their content, and indeed perhaps not most in terms of their content, but more in terms of their structure. So if you look at something like the way animals and wonders are kind of written about in medieval Islamic sources, there are kind of bestiary analogs, but a lot more of the time I feel like they are incorporated into travelogues. So when people write about, you know, wondrous places, they then include the remarkable animals that live there. And there is a whole genre of writing about these kinds of marvels within the Muslim world, and that to some extent draws on the same classical exemplars as the medieval European tradition. But I feel like that European tradition is more likely to have the kind of, and I'm not an expert on the Arabic or Persian manuscript, so, you know, maybe I'm wrong, but I feel like that kind of catalog format is more common among European bestiaries. And I don't know what, I mean, I know there are Chinese texts, for example, that have this kind of, you know, that describe wondrous creatures, but I don't know about that format. So, you know, maybe I shouldn't say it's the one most like, it's just the one that I know about that's most like. So for the creators of medieval European bestiaries, the purpose of these texts, you know, they were inspired by works that were explicitly works of natural history, you know, by writers like Pliny, by Aristotle, but I don't think that their goal was to write works of natural history. I don't know that they necessarily thought that what they were saying about these animals was always true. These were works where the references were literary rather than observational. Certainly, you know, these monks writing about elephants were not, for the most part, people who had ever seen elephants. I think it can be quite hard for us to understand the context within which a lot of medieval works that today would be considered within the bounds of history or science are written, which is that they are written to illuminate what are supposed to be kind of already understood truths. So they are better ways of communicating things rather than investigations into the world around. So if you're in Ireland in the Middle Ages, the panther is largely a literary animal. The fact that also it is a real animal that really exists is kind of secondary to its purpose, in the same way that the fact that, like, Alexander the Great was a real person who really existed was secondary to the literary purpose, right? Perhaps there was a historical Beowulf, perhaps there was a historical King Arthur, but they would bear very little relationship to the literary versions of themselves, which are the ones that we know about. And I hasten to add, I feel like everybody knew this, so I don't think that people were looking into medieval bestiaries to try and find facts about animals in order to prepare themselves for their journeys to the earthly paradise, you know? I think they read them for entertainment, and they read them for, like, moral and spiritual education. In many cases, the purpose of the bestiary is to convey Christian philosophy and Christian morality in the form of a series of fun parables with good-looking illustrations. So for my exemplar bestiary, I'm just going to use the one that I happen to have a nice version of, which is the bestiary found in a manuscript from the Bodleian Library in Oxford. So that's Oxford MS Bodley 764. And this version is translated by Richard Barber. And we're going to start with the entry on the mole. The mole is so called because it is condemned to perpetual darkness because of its blindness. It has no eyes, always digs the earth and turns it over, and eats the roots. The mole, condemned to perpetual blindness, is the image of pagan idols, blind, deaf, and dumb, or even their worshippers, wandering in the eternal darkness of ignorance and folly. Isaiah writes of them, "In that day a man shall cast his idols to the moles and to the bats." That's Isaiah 2:20. That is, the blind shall worship the blind. The mole is also the symbol of heretics, or false Christians, who, like the eyeless mole which digs in the earth, heaping up the soil and eating the roots beneath the crops, lack the light of true knowledge and devote themselves to earthly deeds. They serve the desires of the flesh zealously and succumb to the lure of pleasure while they try in every way possible to gnaw at the roots of all that is good. Now, you may be saying to yourself, James, moles don't eat roots. And I don't think that's really the point, right? I mean, notice how circular the argument is. Moles are blind. This makes them a symbol of idolaters. Idolaters are blind like the mole because they don't recognize the truth, which is what we all already agree it is. That would be a devastating critique if this were meant to be an argument, but it's not meant to be an argument. It's meant to be an illustration. Let's look at another entry. This one is about sirens. Sirens, so the naturalists tell us, are deadly creatures, which from the head down to the navel are like men, but their lower parts down to their feet are like birds. Their music is a song with the sweetest melody, so that if seafaring men hear it afar off, they leave their true course and are lured towards the sirens. The sweetness of the sound enchants the ears and senses and lulls them to sleep. As soon as they are fast asleep, the sirens attack them and devour their flesh, and so the lure of their voices brings ignorant and imprudent men to their death. In the same way, all those who delight in the pomp and vanity and delights of this world, and lose the vigor of their minds by listening to comedies, tragedies, and various musical melodies, will suddenly become the prey of their enemies. One really interesting thing about this bestiary is, as we all know, there is a long history of confusion between sirens and mermaids. You'll see here that sirens are described as having the lower body of a bird, but the illustration shows what would more conventionally be called mermaids, in that their lower bodies are like fishtails and they're underwater, which seems to suggest that the artist had a sufficiently strong preconception of what a siren looked like that he failed to notice that the text actually didn't say that. Maybe he couldn't read. You know, maybe for the illumination, someone just said, "Hey, draw a screech owl," or whatever. The previous one's an owl. And that's what he did. Now, similar texts are found in other parts of the world. So here I'm going to read from The Meadows of Gold and Mines of Precious Gems by the 9th, 10th century traveler and author Masudi. So he's was born in Baghdad in the late 9th century, died in Egypt in the 950s. What we're going to talk about here is some of the stuff from his travels in Egypt. And this is, so as I said, this is from The Meadows of Gold and the Mines of Precious Gems, translated by Paul Lund and Caroline Stone. "When the hippopotamus, which lives in the Nile, gets out of the water and heads for some place on dry land, the inhabitants of Egypt conclude that the flood will reach that very point, neither exceeding it nor falling short. It never fails, for their conclusions are derived from long and constant experience. The hippopotamus, when he leaves the water, is very harmful to the interests of the landowners and to the harvests, for he devours the crops. He comes out of the water at night and heads at once for the farthest points that he intends to reach. Then he returns to the river, grazing on the crops he had previously inspected, as if he had planned in advance exactly what he would eat. After having grazed, he returns to the Nile and drinks. Then he leaves his droppings in various places, and these give rise to a secondary growth of vegetation. When his depredations are extensive and the estates are harmed, the landowners scatter several measures of lupin seeds around the place where he emerges. The creature eats them and goes back to the river, but the lupins expand in his belly, which swells and eventually bursts, and he dies. His body floats on the surface of the water and is hauled to shore. One almost never finds crocodiles in the areas inhabited by hippopotamuses. They resemble a horse, but the hooves and tail are different, and forehead is broader. Now that does not sound like the account of a man who had seen a hippopotamus, and I'm pretty sure that lupin seed story isn't true, although, you know, maybe they scatter some seed that is poisonous to the hippopotamus rather than, like, sprouting in his belly. But notice how it's a whole little snapshot of not just, like, what is the animal like, indeed, what is the animal like is, like, the least detailed part of it, but what effect does it have on the community around it, how does it behave, you know, this is... I'm not saying that this is an accurate description of the hippopotamus, but it is couched in much more naturalistic terms. So Masudi's book is a little bit different. You know, he's writing in the kind of travelogue genre, of which there's a lot in Arabic in this period. You know, but there are kind of European counterparts a bit later on, so he's writing a little more like someone like Marco Polo or John Mandeville. But it's a very interesting, slightly different approach, and I think that there will be some ways in which we can adapt bestiaries that are like Bodley 764, and some ways in which we can adapt monster descriptions like Masudi's. Okay, so in-game, I think that you can have a bestiary in your game in several different ways. The first is that the bestiary is a source of information for the characters, right? Characters acquire a copy of the bestiary, and then they use it as a sort of in-character guide. So like the sections of in-universe writing in the Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 2nd Edition monster book. You know, not all the information has to be accurate, but it's trying to be accurate, and if it's wrong, there should be ways to figure that out, right? It should be checkable against the actual monster's behavior. You should be able to see how someone came to that fake conclusion, or what social pressures they had, right? If you think about the science fiction equivalent of that monster book, the Imperial Infantryman's Uplifting Primer, the Warhammer 40k little handbook for Imperial Guard soldiers, which is full of stuff about how weak and puny all the aliens are. You don't believe that, but then you're very primed not to believe the things that the Imperium's propaganda arm would tell you. So there could be some kind of aspect of propaganda or quackery in this text. So this works in a world where monsters are a real and measurable phenomenon, right? Where monsters are kind of naturalistic. It doesn't work very well in a world either where monsters are like fully supernatural and occult, or a kind of 5e world. Well, it doesn't work for certain types of monsters in that kind of 5e world where monsters are relatively commonplace. Like, there's a 5th edition scenario, and this I believe is adapted from earlier editions as well, where you go to this bar, like this regular bar, and the stuffed and mounted head of a white dragon is over the fireplace. So if you're in a world where, you know, the barkeep knows what a white dragon is like and knows people who've killed one, where the coffee shop is run by a half-orc or whatever, then obviously we're not framing monsters as mysterious and we don't need these kind of guidebooks, right? One way that you could treat this kind of bestiary would be to have it be created by the characters, you know, where the characters are researching or compiling the bestiary, either on their own initiative, because one of the characters is a scholar who wants to put together a book of monsters, or because a patron, you know, some kind of monk or wizard or whatever, is having them do it, you know, so they've got some wealthy, important person who wants to, you know, pretend to everyone like she's been out on the road and been an adventurer, but actually her business interests make that impossible. So she sort of hires these proxies. You know, so they could be field researchers, they could just be freelancers, you know, being paid to record their experiences with monsters. This is handy in particular, I think, if you have a player in your party who likes to draw. It's doubly handy if that same player is playing some kind of opinionated crackpot. I'm sure I've said this before on this show, but every time I say the phrase, like to draw, I'm reminded of the fact that, owing to something my brother said, I can now not hear the opening lines of Shimmy Shimmy Ya as other than, oh baby, I like to draw, oh baby, I like to draw. There's your personal and irrelevant aside for this episode. So this can be really cool. It can produce an IC, like a physical actual document that the characters have contributed to and made this bestiary. I've been fortunate enough to have that for a couple of my games. I ran a LARP for a while, quite a small ongoing LARP where one of the player characters, indeed listener Luke, hi Luke, kept really detailed notes, and he had this, you know, he had this big notebook that he would like paste clue documents into and, you know, go back and like have pages on particular cases or particular characters. And I still have it, you know, as a souvenir of that game. If you're one of those people who runs multiple games set in the same game world, you could even wind up with a situation where one of your player groups was producing this bestiary, this kind of monster scrapbook, and then another player group wound up with that scrapbook as a guide for their characters. One thing that this approach emphasizes is how different monsters may be between concept and play. So imagine a typical page-long 1993 Monsters Manual entry, and think how much of that is going to be visible in an instance of play, right? Maybe not all that much of it. But on the other hand, I think we finally found the context in which all that stuff in the Monsters Manuals about ecology and diet and reproduction might turn out to be relevant. If your characters are playing naturalists, then you actually want, I mean, you can make all this stuff up by yourself, but, you know, it's simpler to actually use those later texts that are much more focused on describing monsters that are gamey or folklore-y in a naturalistic manner. So, that's your first option. Bestiary is a source of world information. The second way to use a bestiary is to have it be a source of misinformation. Like, you might think, you know, why would a text about monsters be riddled with inaccuracies in a world where monsters actually do exist? But if you look at medieval bestiaries, they're full of inaccuracies about animals that absolutely exist. And not just like exotic animals that these monks would have never seen. Like, if they make up a bunch of stuff about the ibex, okay, that's understandable. A bunch of monks in, you know, England and Ireland, maybe they've never seen an ibex. You know, and that seems pretty likely. But it's full of nonsense about, like, beavers and hedgehogs and swallows. In the case of a medieval bestiary, I don't think anybody is expecting this to be true. This is something that I have to convey to my students. When we start doing, like, the transition between the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, we do an exercise using medieval maps. And one of the things that I ask them is, could you use this map to find your way from one place to another? And with the exception of a relatively small number of nautical maps, the answer is usually no. Or pilgrim route maps, which are very different from other kinds of maps. They're not even really maps. They're like itineraries. But medieval maps of the world are not useful for navigation. Of course they're not. What do you think? You're wandering the roads of medieval England with a giant sheepskin looking at all these little illuminated blemmies? No, obviously. You know, the maps are useless for navigation because that is not what they're for. And so you have to look at it and think, not like, oh, these medieval people were so stupid they didn't know these things, but, huh, this doesn't do this thing at all. Maybe, therefore, it is for some other purpose. You know, this is a teaching tool. This is a form of entertainment. This is to illustrate a particular history, but it's not an aid to navigation. So this is a map, and my modern map is a map, but they're not really the same thing. So people looked at this book and went, I don't think these animals actually do that, but that's not really the point. Hares don't really get into races with tortoises. So this works better in a game where truly weird monsters are comparatively rare, right? That kind of slightly Warhammer-y OSR aesthetic where monsters tend to be unique. You know, you don't need a bestiary to tell you about orcs. An orc is just a mean guy with a sword who looks a bit piggy. But you probably do need a bestiary to tell you about a periton or a jackalware. And so if you keep those monsters surrounded in an aura of mystery, if you treat them as unnatural, indeed, if you have them be things that in the world are legendary but maybe don't really exist, then the bestiary there can be useful, whether it's providing information or misinformation. But I feel like misinformation can be a lot of fun. However, it has to be handled very carefully. Because you suckers, you believed what I told you, is a move that you don't want to make except under the absolute, like, most correct circumstances. It works maybe only if the players believe something that is harmful to them, but the truth is actually beneficial to them. So if, for instance, the text says that peritons are, you know, sweet, good-natured creatures, but in fact they are weird man-eaters, and the players, like, buy into the source and then have their characters get tricked, then some people might feel a little bit like you're abusing their trust. And, you know, they wouldn't be completely wrong. By contrast, if they are told that something is a bad guy and it turns out to actually be okay, that kind of subversion of expectations, I think, is usually a little more welcome. There has to be a reason that the bestiary is off, and that reason has to be itself a clue, or it has to be inferable from the attitudes of the characters who created the bestiary. So if, you know, this monk gives you the bestiary and you know that this monk is some kind of intolerant fanatic, then you might be more prepared to sort of be on your guard against the bestiary representing that monk's viewpoint rather than reality. From here, you can go to the third way to approach this, which is to have the bestiary be an unintentional source of information. So maybe the bestiary is like a medieval bestiary, and it's mostly analogies about how hedgehogs teach us to be good followers of St. Cuthbert. But in passing, there are little details that actually function as clues for your players on their adventures. And that makes sense because there is some kind of real information in a lot of these bestiary entries. So if you look at Bodily 764, the elephant entry is mostly a bunch of stuff about like Adam and Eve and how elephants don't have knees and how elephants fight dragons. But even that entry includes one or two real facts about elephants, like that they use their trunks to feed themselves, or that they're used by militaries who build fighting platforms on their backs. So the idea of having some kind of things that are true within a broader context of nonsense, I think has some appeal to it, right? You know, maybe the PCs are reading through the bestiary and they see a familiar item in the illustration of a dragon's horde, or they read an explanation of the symbolic reason a certain herb repels ghouls or whatever. So they get mostly setting philosophy, but it turns out that that herb does repel ghouls. Also, getting setting philosophy from a text can help you, like, ingratiate yourselves with or understand the actions of the followers of that philosophy. But yeah, to get also a little bit of a clue in there, something that is unintentionally true or intentionally true within a broader context that's just a story. The fourth and final way to use a bestiary in your game, I think, is just to have the bestiary be treasure. In the Middle Ages, manuscripts were valuable. Things like Gospels were often very, like, lavishly decorated. You know, you might have covers that had gold or gems on them. But even ordinary manuscripts took a lot of effort to produce and, you know, were very expensive, and monasteries, which is where, you know, most were produced, were very cautious about lending them out, you know, for fear that they might not get them back. And given that, you know, everything had to be hand-copied, and a lengthy text could take a year to do that, you know, months to a year. It all depends on how long the text is, but the recovery of manuscripts could be a pretty lucrative way for player characters to make some money. And in the meantime, they could also learn some monster facts from the text. So if you say, you know, oh, in ages past, the library of, you know, such and such monastery was sacked by the evil followers of the Dark Lord, and obviously his undead legions don't have a whole lot of time for reading, so they took the manuscripts from the library and they just piled them high in his treasure hoards, and since then, who knows where they've gone, but if you bring one to the great lore master, he will reward you and fill your hat with gold or whatever, and you do something with that. And, you know, in the meantime, you can use it to deliver clues or deliver setting history or whatever. So I think that, you know, medieval bestiaries played a wide variety of different roles. They weren't really primarily for informing people about the natural world, but about using the natural world to tell certain types of stories. Now, again, I don't want to position those as kind of having like one fixed meaning. So I think that a lot of people engage with those stories as like fun stories about kooky animals rather than necessarily appreciating them all as Christian allegories. But, you know, you can have them either be direct sources of setting information or ways of communicating the setting even through misinformation, like where what people believe isn't true, but it's also important to know what people believe. I think of these options, my favorite one is the one where the players are making the bestiary. I think anything that encourages that kind of like karaoke atmosphere where players who maybe don't normally like, they don't like drawing or they don't like writing, are encouraged to help contribute to this kind of scrapbook bestiary in a way that is that feels welcoming, you know, where they don't feel like they're being judged because they can't draw or whatever. Well, they're just like, you know, even if they're just like pasting in pictures of monsters that they found on the internet or what have you, that's still contributing and I think it's still a lot of fun. So I like the idea of having the bestiary as an additive document created by PCs during play, and if I could then in a different game use it to like be given to other PC groups, I think that would be a lot of fun. All right, so Tobias, that is what I think about bestiaries. Once again, thank you so much for your support, and I hope that you enjoyed this episode. Everyone else, again, if you'd like to be like Tobias and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you would prefer to pledge at a different level, there are also rewards for you there if you do that. Also, If you would like to support the show, but don't want to or aren't able to do so financially, one thing that would be super useful would be if you could leave us a rating or review on the podcasting app of your choice. I'd like to tell you to be honest, unless you don't think this is a five-star show, in which case I would like to tell you to be nice. Next week, I got to tell you right now that the schedule for next week is a little bit up in the air because we have a very special episode that I'm hoping will be ready for you next week, but it might be the week after next. So just stay tuned to this channel to find out more about what's coming up next on Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons attribution license. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.